Acorn in Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
I am honored indeed to be speaking for the next few minutes with Zane Asher, who is an anchor on CNN International, leading her own program, and highly regarded journalist, and now the author of a remarkable memoir about a remarkable family, and in particular, her remarkable mother. The book is titled, Where the Children Take Us, How One Family Achieved the Unimaginable. The book chronicles the story of Zane Asher's family, a family that was living in South London, her parents both from Nigeria, and it was a family rocked by almost unimaginable tragedy, and it was in particular the incredible fortitude shown by her mother, and for that matter by her grandmother, that helped keep the family together, and ultimately Zane Asher and her three siblings have gone on to very, very successful lives themselves. Zane Asher, as already mentioned, a CNN anchor, her brother, an Oscar-nominated actor, a sister, a medical doctor, and another brother, a successful entrepreneur. And this great success is all the more remarkable given the incredible difficulties faced by her mother in just trying to hold things together in the wake of terrible tragedy. It's an incredibly inspiring story. The book published by Amistad, again titled Where the Children Take Us, How One Family Achieved the Unimaginable. Zane Asher, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
This is a remarkable story indeed. Before we get to the tragedy that in so many respects is at the heart of this story, and by the way, you say so eloquently right at the outset, there is tragedy in my story, but my story is not a tragedy, and indeed that is true. We do, of course, do have to talk about that tragedy at the heart of the story, but first, tell us about your two parents before their lives were engulfed by tragedy. Explain where they came from and just a little bit about them.
Yeah, so my parents, my mom and my dad, met when my mom was around 14 years old. And they really were the loves of each other's lives. They met in a tiny village in rural Nigeria. My dad was a couple of years older than her. And their love sort of blossomed during the Biafra War, which was a civil war in Nigeria. That, you know, the only way to describe it was the stuff of nightmares. I mean, our tribe that was based in the eastern part of the country essentially tried to secede from Nigeria as a whole, fighting for their own independence. And as a result, 2 million people died largely of starvation. And so during that war, my parents' love story really began to ironically blossom, because they had just met before the war, and then they were separated, and my dad during the war tried to track my mother down. They were just, it was really what I would describe as love at first sight. And at the end of the war, towards the end, he finally tracked her down. He'd gone with his own family from village to village to village, asking sort of every kind of extended family member what they knew about the Okafor family and whether, you know, the Okafor family, that's my mother's maiden name, they'd seen them. And so my dad, you know, eventually tracked her down in the tiny area. And then once the war ended, they set off to Europe together. And the move to first Paris and then London was a big deal for them because obviously our country had been rocked by this massive civil war. But my parents really believed in the promise and the hope in terms of what England offered, in terms of having a better life and the educational opportunities for their children. So a classic immigrant story.
Mm. So they eventually settled in South London and owned and operated a small pharmacy there. Your father made an interesting decision at some point, I suppose, during the summer of 1988, that he wanted to return to Nigeria with one of your brothers. Explain the interesting reason why your father felt that this father-son trip back to Nigeria was an important thing to do, in particular, for your brother.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, when you're a minority growing up in England in the late 80s, I mean, it can be quite difficult. Britain had, in the early 70s when my mother got there was this whole sort of movement of keep England white. You know, that was a common refrain among the far right, keep England white. And so,
Wow. You
know, obviously the 80s were somewhat removed from that. Things had gotten better. But, you know, my brother was made fun of, and it was difficult for him, especially as one of the few sort of black African children in his class. And so my dad came up with this idea that maybe if his son knew more about his heritage and his culture, you know, he would be able to sort of stand up for himself, and he would have the sort of self-confidence to not cower in the face of all that bullying. So he wanted to show my brother just sort of the rich history that Nigeria encompassed and every sort of great thing this country had to offer. So we were all already going to Nigeria for a family wedding in the summer of 1988, August 1988. My mom's brother was getting married. And my father decided to, at the end of that trip, peel off with my brother alone to sort of travel by car across Nigeria. So that was the reason that they did that. And me, my other brother, and my mother returned to London.
And unfortunately, a phone call was received then in early September that there had been a terrible car accident. And one of the circumstances which made that news even more terrible was the uncertainty about whether one of them or both of them had been killed in this terrible accident. And ultimately, of course, what was learned is that your father was killed and your brother very, very seriously injured, the only person in this large car to survive this terrible accident. And your mother makes her way back to Nigeria to that hospital where she ultimately learns that her husband, your father, had been killed, and her 11-year-old son lay critically injured. One of the interesting decisions that she made, or choices she made, was to not tell your brother about his father's fate. Only some days later was he ultimately told Dad didn't make it. And I'm trying to remember now who it is, which of your siblings didn't understand what those words meant, that Dad didn't make it. Was that the son who had been in this accident?
Well, that was actually me as well. So, we had all gone back to Nigeria once, you know, we sort of knew that something really awful had happened. My mother actually went back first. And as you point out, she was in the kitchen in our house in South London waiting for a phone call from my dad saying, oh, yes, we've landed at the airport. It would have either been Gatwick or Heathrow. Come and pick us up. And that's what she was waiting for in our house in South London. And that phone call just never came. And she was like, what's going on? This is so strange. Their flight was supposed to land at this time, but we haven't heard at all from them. So my mother got really sort of worried and sort of panicked. She had assumed or guessed that maybe there was either a massive flight delay or maybe they'd missed their flight. And then she gets a phone call several hours after their flight was supposed to have landed. And the voice on the other end of the line basically said, you know, your husband and your son have been in a car crash. One of them is dead and we don't know which one. And the uncertainty was because initially bystanders and authorities at the scene thought that everybody had passed away. And then, you know, that got sort of, that message got sent to extended relatives who then, you know, thought that everyone had passed away. But then eventually there were rumors that maybe one person had survived, maybe one person, the little boy, had survived. But there was no real way of verifying it because this is 1980s Nigeria. There's no sort of cell phones. And it's sort of happening in terms of hearsay. One person tells one person tells one person. And so people were sort of literally arguing and trying to work out the facts of what had happened when they actually called my mother to tell her, to break the news to her. So she went to Nigeria, not knowing who she was going to be burying in her family that week. And as you point out, it turned out to be my father. But then my oldest brother and I then went back to Nigeria as well. But we were only told initially that, you know, that there had actually been a sort of very serious accident. People really wanted to shield us from the fact that our father had passed away. And so even when my mother knew that my father had passed away, we weren't all immediately told. I mean, obviously, we're children. And so it was very delicately managed in terms of how we were told. And so when eventually we were reunited with our mother in Nigeria, she said to us, me and my oldest brother, that Dad didn't make it. And I was only 5 years old, so I still did not really understand what that meant and why I hadn't seen him yet. And it took me a really long time to actually mourn the death of my father. I think it took me until I was sort of maybe 11, 12 years old to fully understand. Because you're so young at 5 years old, you just don't really, like I had heard eventually that, you know, he'd passed away and I would hear people talking about the fact that he died, but I just didn't understand why he wasn't home. And so it took me a long time to actually fully mourn him, many, many years before I actually understood what had happened.
And among other things in your book, you describe some of the traditions that are part of mourning, that, for instance, your mother had somebody shave her head and she wore white rather than, of course, the black that we think about here in America. When one is in mourning, and of course, all of you slowly try to come to terms with this terrible tragedy. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. I'm speaking with CNN's Zane E. Asher, talking about her new book called "Where the Children Take Us: How One Family Achieved the Unimaginable." So, your mother and you and your siblings return to South London. And there are many days go by where you scarcely see your mother. You describe her kind of staggering down the stairs each morning just to make sure there's food in the kitchen. And then she kind of staggers back up to the privacy of her bedroom to just weep and wail, one imagines, for hours on end. And it is a whole week before she is finally able to bring herself to open up the suitcase that your dad had with him at the accident, which survived the accident. And what ultimately seems to have made such a difference in the very early going, in those very difficult early days, was when your grandmother came to the scene. Describe what she was like and the enormous difference that she made in her own inimitable way in those heartbreaking days.
Yeah, my grandmother was a true force. And, I mean, as is my mother, to be honest, but my grandmother is where my mother gets it from. She is all about tough love. She is extremely resilient. You know, she has a beautiful spirit and a beautiful soul, and she's very kind, but at the same time, somewhat, if I'm honest, distant and all about sort of hard work and discipline. And you sort of, you know, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you just continue. And so her whole sort of message to my mother is, listen, your children need you. You know, this horrible accident has happened. There's nothing we can do to change it. Your children need to. It's time to stop sort of hiding away in your bedroom at this point. I mean, your children barely see you. And so, you know, it took my mother a while to emerge from that kind of grief. It really was, the only way I can describe it is sort of like an emotional earthquake. in terms of what happened in our household that month. And so my mother was very absent, and my grandmother just wouldn't stand for it anymore. And so, you know, my grandmother, her role was to sort of help my mother, you know, help my mother back on her feet, but also to make sure that we had some semblance of routine, some semblance of discipline, some semblance of order. Mm. So that was her role, and she played a really sort of key part in, you know, helping us transition.
I thought it was really interesting at one point when you just say that your grandmother, whose name literally meant, I think, Big Mama, had little tolerance for fuzzy emotion. In other words, she came in there, I mean, very much, of course, loving your mother and all of you, but she came in with a kind of tough love that helped, in a sense, restore some sense of order and framework, particularly at a time when your mother seems to have been incapable of sort of imposing that on her own. Interestingly enough, where your mother seems to have turned a corner in terms of being able to kind of gather up herself and her resolve came out of something incredibly painful involving your oldest brother and some of the terrible trouble that he found himself in. And one might not necessarily expect something good to come out of something like that. Explain the difficulties of your older brother. Is his name pronounced Obinze?
Yeah, Obinze.
Obinze.
That's right.
Go ahead.
So Obinze was, he was 14 when my father passed away, and it's such a difficult age for, I mean, you know, the father-son bond in any family is sacred. It's absolutely sacred. And when you're transitioning from sort of being a boy to being a real teenager and then adult, that's when you really need a father figure the most. And suddenly, he didn't have one. So there was no sense of direction. My mother wasn't there and able to parent. He was really on his own. And, you know, it began to sort of show up at school, that kind of anger and sort of resentment at the world, if you will, for taking away his father. And my brother, Obinze, who was actually a really good student, you know, he was somebody who, when he was a kid, one of the head teachers at his school actually told my parents, this child is too intelligent to be here. You need to send him to a much better school, because he was just so bright and so curious. And at his then school, he was winning sort of awards, best in science, best in math, best in English, that sort of thing. And my parents would actually have to go to big ceremonies at his school, and they were so proud of him. And then after this accident, it was almost as if, I write in the book, but it was almost as if he sort of went into his bedroom one day and emerged a completely different person, suddenly getting into fights in school, suddenly yelling at his teachers, insulting them. And eventually he got kicked out of school. He got expelled. That was a massive wake-up call to my mother, because it just sort of signaled to her, my gosh, like, you know, your children really do need you. Your family's future is teetering on the brink. And it is time to sort of get serious about routine, about order, about discipline, because our family was literally going off the rails. Obinze, the star student, had been expelled, you know, for behavior that was so out of character. So that was a wake-up call to her.
One of her sort of, in a sense, mantras at that moment in terms of what she said to Obinze, and I assume to the rest of you as well, was these intriguing four words: remember who you are. Remember who you are. What do you see as the significance of those words? Why was that such an important thing to say at that moment in time, at this difficult point in your family's life?
Well, so my mother sort of said those words to herself. And that's sort of where she drew her strength, this idea of remembering who you are. So remember that my mother came of age during one of the most, I think, vicious civil wars in African history. She is a survivor. She is somebody who had survived all sorts of you know, issues with starvation. I mean, when the Biafra War was raging, my mother and her family had to eat snakes to survive. They had to eat termites. They had to eat crickets. That was very common at that time because there was literally no food. And my mother, being the oldest sibling, she was sort of in charge of making sure that the younger kids had food. And so one of her jobs was to go to the market. A lot of the markets operated at night in order to sort of hide from, you know, enemy planes. And she would sell cassava. And, you know, hopefully the idea would be to use the money that she made to find some way of getting food for the rest of the family. And I remember her telling me about, and I write about it in the book, this one time where suddenly in the middle of this sort of peaceful evening commerce, selling cassava, machine gun fire started raining down and there was a massive explosion. And her younger brother immediately, only 14, 15 years old at that time, immediately fled into the bush. And when they turned back, the marketplace was utter carnage. People that she had been speaking to and doing business with just minutes earlier, you know, lying lifeless on the ground. There was blood everywhere. And it's a lot to absorb as a teenager. I mean, it was really a sort of dreadful time to come of age. And to go through all of that, it really does change who you are as a person. It truly strengthens you. So my mother has, and has always had, after growing up through that, I mean, that war was 2.5 years, but to grow up through that, not be in school, you're in charge of taking care of the family at 14, 15 years old. You're literally risking your life to make sure that your younger siblings had food to eat. You know, there is an inner strength that comes from that. So when she said to herself, remember who you are, that was the well that she was trying to draw from.
Hmm. Well, fortunately, your older brother, Abinze, is eventually entered into another school and, in a sense, given a new start. You yourself had some terrible difficulties in school, despite your intelligence and great promise. At one point in the book, you write, "It was at school where I felt most alone." And some of that crushing sadness led to you having very serious academic difficulties that eventually were shared with your mother in a parent-teacher conference. And your mother's response to that was really, really interesting. Tell our listeners what your mother requested from your teachers and what she proceeded to do from there.
Yeah, so, you know, the book, even though it has obviously tragedy at the beginning, is a real sort of celebration of how my mother carried us on her back and really fought for us to give us a better life despite the staggering tragedy when we were very, very young. And the sorts of things that she did to enable us to fulfill our dreams. So obviously I'm an anchor at CNN. You mentioned my brother who was nominated for an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, and my sister, a doctor, my oldest brother, a very successful entrepreneur. And one of the things she did, I mean, this moment when my mother went to this sort of parent-teacher conference was a big turning point because she now knows that I'm not doing well in school, that I am distant, that I don't really hand in my homework on time. I mean, she's obviously, as a mother, aware of this, you know, but she's so busy that she's not able to be fully present. But this was a big wake-up call for her. So she asked my teachers for the school syllabus for the entire year. She comes home and she figures out what I am going to be learning in, say, a month or two from then. And she proceeds to teach it to me in advance so that by the time it comes up in school, I would have already mastered it. And this was genius. It was genius because it meant that, you know, I would go to class and after being, you know, not a very good student, even at that young age, I suddenly became, quote unquote, the best student in class. Because everything that came up, whether it was the times tables or, you know, learning how to tell time, I already knew it because my mother taught it to me at home well before we learned it in school. So the teachers began to believe that I was actually much smarter than I actually was. And they would praise me and I would win all sorts of awards in school. And, you know, at that age, it's like it's sort of gold stars. And, you know, you're now being sort of lauded and acclaimed as a role model for the other students. And on a subconscious level, it has a profound impact because school then becomes a place where a child feels like they could shine. And especially, you know, being a minority and sort of not feeling like I fitted in, that meant the world to me. And it fueled my desire to go home and study more and then do even better. Hmm. It became a cycle. And so now that school became a place that I could shine, because my mother taught me everything well ahead of time, well ahead of, you know, before it was presented in class, I loved the sort of attention and the praise that I got, and I wanted to go home and study more.
Hmm.
And so that, it changed my entire school trajectory, even at that young age.
And the parallel you draw between that and some of your mother's experiences with her own schooling during the most tumultuous years back in Nigeria, that's just extraordinary to think about what she experienced there in terms of her own mother trying to keep her learning going even when so much of life was, in a sense, falling apart. That's one of the most inspiring stories in your book, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It was when my mother was a teenager growing up during the Biafra War, my grandmother actually would do something very similar. My mother wasn't in school for 2.5 years during the war, and so my grandmother would try in a very, very basic way to teach my mother what she thought my mother would be learning had she been in school. So it was very basic math. It was Igbo folk tales. We're from the Igbo tribe originally. And it was sort of things like that. But that's where my mother got the idea from, to teach me in advance. It's because of her experiences during the war.
Well, we have just scratched the surface in terms of the story of your mother's ferocious devotion to her children and the way in which she worked so tirelessly and so creatively to hold the family together, to propel each of you on your various paths of success. One of the things I just want to take a moment to have you talk about is your brother who was in this terrible accident, who ultimately has gone on to be a renowned actor nominated for an Oscar. I think one of the most moving stories of you tell about him is when he first fell in love with Shakespeare and, in your words, discovered himself in the tragedy and drama Shakespeare had so beautifully crafted 4 centuries earlier. Can you just say a real quick word about this powerful moment in your brother's life?
Yeah, so my brother, you know, after the accident, he was also in a very different way, quite sort of withdrawn in school as well. I mean, he was lonely. He was just, sad, you know, after not just losing my dad, but actually being the last person to see my father alive. And remember, my dad had actually gone on that road trip to help my brother. So there's also some, I don't know whether at 11 you would synthesize it this way, but later years, there was certainly a sense of guilt as well. And so, in an English class in 1990, my brother had turned about 13 years old, he discovers Shakespeare. They are reading Henry IV, Part 1 for the first time. And there's something about the sort of complexities of Shakespeare's characters that really speak to his soul, even at that young age. And he became obsessed with Shakespeare, obsessed from that moment onward, so much so that he would go home and start writing Shakespeare's most famous quotes all over his walls. And my mother, of course, coming from Nigeria, and her education was obviously interrupted by war, she has no idea what these quotes are. She thinks they're mumbo jumbo, she thinks they're gibberish, and she just gets really upset with him and starts painting over the words on the wall. But he would continue to do it over and over again, writing, scribbling Shakespeare all over his walls. And then eventually one of my brother's teachers said to my mom, listen, this boy is incredibly talented. Have you ever seen your son act? My brother was doing, all these sort of after-class drama clubs at school and getting ready for his first sort of theatrical performance at school. And my mother, just being overworked, a single mother, 4 kids, she hadn't. And she really, if I'm honest, wasn't interested. She didn't really understand anything about the performing arts or acting or anything like that. She didn't really believe that acting could put food on the table. If anything, she wanted her children to be doctors and lawyers, etc. And eventually this teacher persuades her, no, you really have to see your son perform. And she goes for the very first time. My brother's in Measure for Measure. That was his first Shakespeare play in terms of performing at school. And at the end, my mother doesn't really understand what they're saying on stage. You know, she's just sort of watching. But at the end, you know, my brother comes out after the curtain call and he gets this massive standing ovation and the whole auditorium is erupting in applause for her son. And I mean, to be a sort of African woman, a West African woman, an immigrant, and to sort of see in this all-white auditorium in London, everybody sort of erupting and sort of showering with your son with all this acclaim was quite a remarkable thing. I mean, it made her pause for a minute. And it made her realize that actually maybe there's something here. I mean, this is actually incredible. She could see that her son was coming back to life and that there was a passion in his eyes, even though she didn't understand what Shakespeare basically was or, you know, what he was even saying on stage. And so after that moment, she actually proceeds to read her very first Shakespeare play by herself. And, you know, for her, I mean, obviously it's very difficult to understand the language, but just the very act of it, it was a sign to her and to the rest of the family that she was now serious in trying to find her own small ways of pushing my brother to be his best self, you know, and they would rehearse together. So if my brother had a play, if he was, you know, going to do Othello or if he was going to do Measure for Measure again, my mother would play one part and he would play the other. And so it was just this sort of like the book is filled with all these sorts of remarkable moments of dedication that my mother displayed, that no matter what we wanted to achieve and no matter where we were going with our dreams, you know, she was going to stand behind us 100%. Around the same time, she created what she referred to as the 8-hour rule. And that is she would make us divide our days into three equal parts, so 24 hours in a day. And she would sort of say, okay, well, three equal parts, 8 hours each. She would say 8 hours should be spent sleeping. And then she would say, you know, the next 8 hours should obviously be spent in school. You know, that's what most kids do. And then she would say that the last 8 hours of our day should somehow be spent working towards our dreams. And that was an important moment for us because it really synthesized this idea that, you know, how you spend your time is really important, because at the end of the day, my mother would explain to us that everybody generally sleeps for roughly around 8 hours. And everybody in the working world, if they're lucky enough to just have one job, they're generally at work for 8 or 9 hours. So the only real advantage you have in your life is how you spend the last 8 hours of your day. And so the book is filled with so many different, I guess, creative and original ways that my mother pushed us to be our best selves.
Hmm. And it's an amazing, inspiring story. Again, the book is titled Where the Children Take Us, How One Family Achieved the Unimaginable, published by Amistad. Zane E. Asher, congratulations on this remarkable book, and thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show today. I was honored to speak with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Likewise. I appreciate it.
And I wanted to just make brief mention of two other things said in the book that I wish we had had time to talk about. One of the things Zane E. Asher discusses in her book is the legacy of the nation of Nigeria, which she says does not necessarily have the richest of resources to share with the world. But one area in which the nation of Nigeria shines is in the quality of children that it has shared with the world. It's children who have gone to other places and achieved amazing things. She quotes an interesting statistic that as of the year 2006, Nigerians were the most educated immigrant group in the United States. She also talks about how Nigeria, because it has experienced so much difficulty in its history, that it is ultimately a culture that has found hope with so little. Finally, this intriguing quote from the first chapter of the book, in which she talks about her mother carrying us through a staggering tragedy. My mother would tell you she did nothing special. In a way, I suppose she's right. She simply raised us the way she had been raised, the way her parents had been raised before her, and theirs before them. In the remote Nigerian village where she grew up, this is just what parents do. Again, her lovely and illuminating memoir is titled Where the Children Take Us, How One Family Achieved the Unimaginable, published by Amistad, the author Zane E. Asher. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive.
I am tremendously honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with Julius Lester, a very compelling author of various books which tell the story of African Americans. And he is responsible for a number of award-winning books, including the Newbery Honor Book, To Be a Slave, the Caldecott Honor Book, John Henry, the National Book Award finalist, Long Journey Home, and most recently, a beautiful book called Let's Talk About Race. Julius Lester is a well-known figure in a number of different ways, and for over three decades on the faculty at the University of Massachusetts. And Julius Lester, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And it is great to have this opportunity to talk with you. We've had several interviews as of late about, in light of Martin Luther King Day, about Dr. King and the civil rights movement in general. And it occurs to me now as I sit down to speak with you for the next few minutes that one of the things basically left out of the equation in all of these conversations that we've had, compelling as they have been, has been children and talking with children about matters relating to race and prejudice. Tell us, first of all, the special challenges that are involved in trying to approach topics like this when writing to or speaking with, for that matter, children.
Well, I think the primary challenge is one of simply finding the right language in which to speak to children about issues, to do so in a way that a child can grasp and understand. And so that one, the way that I do that in many of the books that I write is to make it personal to the child. And so that in the book, Let's Talk About Race, which is for children ages 4 to 7, I begin the book by talking about the fact that I'm a story, that everybody is a story. And so I then go on to present different elements of my story, where I was born, when I was born, what my parents did, what my hobbies are, my favorite colors, and all those kinds of things which are common to anybody's story. And then I mention, I'm also black. And so what I'm doing is really not making my race the central fact of my identity, but simply making it one facet of my identity. And so I think that making it personal to a child gives the child a way in, gives the child a way of relating, gives the child a way of seeing how this applies to me.
One of the most striking moments in the book is when you raise the obvious reality to us, and maybe for a young child it might not yet be an obvious reality, the fact that some people say that their race, their own race, is better than another race.
Right.
And then you pose the question, why would some people say that their race is better than another? And I think your answer is exactly right, but it nonetheless comes a little bit as a surprise to me as I read the next page. Tell us your answer to that question and why you answer the question the way you do.
Well, one way that I answer the question by saying that sometimes people say that they that their race is better is because they are afraid. And then, but ultimately, the ultimate answer is simply because. There's really no reason why someone should say that except that they want to feel superior to other people. That certainly Western history had defined whiteness as being better than anything that was not white. And I think that those kind of that kind of a definition really comes out of a fear of difference, a fear of not being in control. But ultimately, prejudice is irrational.
I mean, I find that very striking that your initial answer is, why do they, because they feel bad about themselves, because they are afraid. In a sense, it's a very sympathetic way, in a sense, to look at racial prejudice. And not everybody takes the time to think about it in those kind of terms.
Well, that's a very, very good description. I don't think that dialogue between people of various races is really fostered by anger, by recrimination, by accusing people of being racist or this, that, or the other. I think that one of the things that make Dr. King so effective was that Dr. King was certainly angry about the way things were in America at that time, but that he did not direct that anger at individuals. He directed his anger at the injustices. And so that I think that the attitude that we bring to the conversation have to be ones of sympathy and empathy for the other people involved in the conversation.
We're speaking with Julius Lester, and we're talking about his book, which is a beautiful children's book, although I think a whole lot of people need to read this book. It's called Let's Talk About Race. At one point in the book, you suggest that whoever is reading it should help you with what you call a true story, and you want them to do a little experiment, which really can lead one to a profound understanding about us as human beings. Tell us what the reader is supposed to do.
Well, what I ask the reader to do is to take their hands and to press against their cheek or press someplace on their face and to press hard enough until they feel the bone beneath the skin. And then I ask them to do the same thing with to press on the face of a parent or a friend or what have you and feel the bone beneath that person's skin. And then to realize that beneath the skin, we all look the same. Beneath the skin, that we are all comprised of very hard bone, and that if we all took our skins off, you could not tell who was male, who was female, who was black, white, Asian, Hispanic, or what have you. And so then why don't we simply stop putting value judgments on race and simply begin to treat each other in terms of the reality. And the reality is that, we're the same underneath the skin.
Well, and that we are so much more than our race. You say at one point, your race is not all that you are. My race is not all that I am. Yes, I am black, but I am also a man. I am of medium height. I have a deep voice and a loud laugh. I love to laugh to you. I live in a big house in the woods in a small town. I like pancakes and macaroni and cheese. And we flip the page, and you say, I am so many things besides my race. You know, as I think about the interviews I've done over the last several days, and I think about the audio recordings of Bull Connor from the heart of the Deep South at the height of the civil rights movement, I wonder what difference might it have made if Bull Connor had held in his hands a book like this, which might have helped him look at the whole issue of race differently than he and so many other people did.
Well, I don't know that somebody like Bull Connor that it would have made any difference for. Unfortunately, there are people who might look at this book and it not mean anything at all to them. They would reject it entirely. But, I'm an idealist, and so maybe it would have made a difference to Bull Connor, because what I'm saying is it seems to me to be so simple and so obvious, and the scientific information that we're getting from the DNA studies and the genome studies tell us that 99% of our genetic makeup is identical. And so that Why can't we focus on that 99% rather than focus on the 1% that is different?
We should mention that this book is a beautiful thing to behold, aside from your very meaningful text. Tell us about the illustrations of the book and the talented woman responsible for them.
The artist is Karen Barber, and I've never met her. And she just did a wonderful, wonderful job of illustrating the book in a way that it is just a very happy, joyous book to look at and to hold. And it definitely complements the words and extends the words in terms of the kind of emotion I want children and parents to leave with when they finish the book, which is simply the joy of being alive.
One last question, if I may.
Sure.
I think one mistake which a lot of adults make, and I'm probably one of them, is that when we take a children's book in hand, we maybe don't think, I could do that, but I think most adults have little or no sense of the challenges that are involved in writing a children's book. I think we assume that it is a lot easier than it actually is. I mean, you can take in hand some big 1,000-page biography of Winston Churchill and think, wow, that is a real accomplishment. But I don't think we necessarily appreciate the accomplishment that a very, very good children's book represents. Just try to give us some sense of what makes writing a very good children's book a challenge in order to do it well.
Well, I appreciate your comment, and your observations are quite accurate. Writing children's books are very, very difficult, primarily because children are such a demanding audience. And children are far more demanding audiences than adults. They are much more severe critics than adults. And you really have to write in such a way that it really involves children in a serious way, whether you're writing a serious book or whether you're writing a book that has a lot of humor in it. Children are a tough audience. And I love the challenge of writing for children. And if children are introduced to good literature when they're young, then they will continue to read good literature throughout their lives.
Well, I certainly hope a lot of children will have the opportunity to read this beautiful book called Let's Talk About Race. It's published by HarperCollins Publishers, and its author, Julius Lester. Julius Lester, my congratulations to you. A great pleasure to speak with you about your book on this morning's show. I thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for a very thoughtful interview.
Tomorrow on the morning show for Holocaust Remembrance Day, I'm going to be replaying a memorable conversation I recorded with a woman from Racine named Edith Eisenberg, who recounts in such touching fashion her family's narrow escape from Germany to find a home here in the United States. That will be for Holocaust Remembrance Day tomorrow on the morning show. On Friday, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, pays his monthly visit to the program to offer his thoughts on an array of current events and issues, including the U.S. economy and the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Next week, some very interesting programs, including on Monday, a conversation with Steve Binder, who was the producer and director of Elvis Presley's memorable and groundbreaking comeback television special in 1968. Steve Binder, who will soon turn 90 years old, has just written a really interesting behind-the-scenes look at this important special. And you'll hear my conversation with him on Monday. On Tuesday, I look forward to sharing with you an interview that I hope to be recording later today with Dalen Instinus. He's the son of Doug Instinus, director of the Racine Theater Guild. And Dalen is a brilliantly talented volleyball player and has just spent an eventful year playing professional volleyball in Sweden. And we're going to be hearing about